From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm David Bean Cooley, in for Terry Gross. On today's Fresh Air, we remember bluegrass banjo player Earl Scruggs. He died Wednesday at the age of 88. He developed his famous three-finger picking style while absent-mindedly playing the banjo one day.
When I realized what I was doing, I was playing the way that I play now. It was like having a dream and wake up, you're actually playing the tune.
Also, we remember Harry Cruz, a writer of Southern Gothic novels full of freaks and losers who have unusual talents. He says his strength as a writer came from
back there in Bacon County, Georgia, with all that sickness and hookworm and rickets and ignorance and beauty and loveliness.
Cruz died Wednesday at the age of 76. And AMC's The Killing and HBO's Game of Thrones are both returning Sunday for their sophomore seasons. I'll have a review. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli of the website TV Worth Watching, sitting in for Terry Gross. The great bluegrass musician Earl Scruggs perfected the three-finger style of banjo picking that became standard in bluegrass. Country singer Porter Wagner once said, "Earl Scruggs was to the five-string banjo what Babe Ruth was to baseball." Scruggs was half of the duo, completed by guitarist Lester Flatt, responsible for such bluegrass standards as Foggy Mountain Breakdown and the theme to the Beverly Hillbillies. Earl Scruggs died in Nashville Wednesday at age 88. In 1945, Scruggs joined Bill Monroe's band, the band that virtually invented bluegrass. In 1948, Flatt and Scruggs left Monroe to form their own group and became one of the most popular acts in country music. Their hit Foggy Mountain Breakdown became even more famous when it was used on the soundtrack of the 1967 movie Bonnie and Clyde. In 1969, Earl Scruggs formed his own band, the Earl Scruggs Review, with his sons Gary and Randy. Terry Gross spoke with Earl Scruggs in 2003. He had just released a new CD called The Three Pickers, which also featured Doc Watson and Ricky Skaggs. Here's a song from that album, Feast Here Tonight.
There's a remedy. I'll get me a briar and I'll twist in his hair. That way I'll get him, I know.
I know,
I know,
I know,
I surely know. That way I'll get him, I know. I'll get me a briar and I'll twist in his hair. And that way I'll get him, I know.
All right, Earl.
Earl Scruggs, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you.
Now, you grew up during the Depression. Your father died when you were four. How did your family make a living when he died?
He was a farmer also. So I stayed on the farm until I got old enough to get a job in the factory. And on the farm, you work from daylight till dark. And in the factory, you work 8 hours. So I thought that was great.
Right. Who did you hear play banjo before you started playing yourself? I mean, I've read that there was no radio in your house when you were growing up.
No.
Who did you hear? How did you hear them?
We had a banjo in our home. My father played the old-style banjo, so I had a banjo there, and my brother Horace had a guitar, and so we just started playing just old tunes that we'd heard before, and then a little later we got a Sears Roebuck radio and started listening to some, mainly the Grand Ole Opry and some programs like that. But as far as the style banjo that I play, nobody had played it before me. And the only thing that is different from my playing from what I'd heard is as I had a three-finger roll, it's later been called Scruggs style. But it seemed to help me to play slow tunes as well as up-tempo tunes. Most of the banjo playing in the old days were hoedown type tunes, up-tempo tunes.
So could you put into words what your style of picking is, the three-finger style?
Well, it's just what you hear. It's a little misleading, say, three fingers. It's actually two fingers, middle and index finger, and your thumb. And it's a kind of, some of the rolls will go, if you number your thumb one, the index two, and your middle finger three, it's like a 1-2-3 roll over and over. But to do a tune, it's like trying to say every word with the same same amount of syllables in the word. You've got to alternate the roll some to make the tune flow.
since you didn't have a radio when you were very young and you didn't have a record player,
yeah.
So you're just like hearing, you know, musicians who may have been, you know, living where you were. How did you come up with your style of playing, with your style of picking?
I guess the old days, you have one main room you have, you take company to when they come, that you don't use every day. So I was in what we call the front room with a banjo one day, and I was in a mode where if somebody had asked me what was I thinking about, and I bet you've been in that mode yourself, you couldn't tell them what you was thinking about. You were just kind of sitting there. And I was picking the banjo, and I was playing a tune that's still played today called Reuben. And when I realized what I was doing, I was playing the way that I play now. It was like having a dream and wake up, you're actually playing the tune. So that was the mode I was in and what I was doing when I learned exactly what I'm doing today.
Now, you joined Bill Monroe's Bluegrass Boys in 1945. This was the group that basically created the sound that's become known as bluegrass. When you joined the band, could you hear that something different was happening there?
Oh, yeah. Nobody had had this style of banjo in the group, and he just did the type of tunes that would make the banjo sound good. So it was a good shot to start with, because he had the Grand Ole Opry exposure, and that gave me a lot of exposure when I went to work with him. And it got immediate attention because nobody had heard that kind of a banjo picking. So it caught on real fast with the public.
Why don't we hear one of your recordings with Bill Monroe from 1947? This is one of the famous ones, Bluegrass Breakdown, with Bill Monroe on mandolin, Lester Flatt, guitar, my guest Earl Scruggs, banjo, recorded in 1947. Monroe and his Bluegrass Boys, recorded in 1947 with my guest Earl Scruggs on banjo. You're considered one of the first banjo players to be a serious musician and to not be a comic with a banjo. A lot of banjo players before you would tell comic monologues or sing comic songs with banjo accompaniment. And in fact, there's a story that may be apocryphal that Uncle Dave Macon, the banjo player, said after hearing you the first time, he ain't one damn bit funny. Did you realize that you were a departure from that, a departure from the kind of comic tradition of banjo playing?
I used to try to study to see if it's some kind of routine I wanted to do as being a comedian, because every banjo player, and there were very few, but they all were comedians, and kind of used the banjo as a prop to get into their comedy routine. But all my interest was just in picking not only tunes but songs behind singers, not only in the lead part but doing a backup. You know what I mean by backup?
Mm-hmm.
Playing a alto or something to support the singer. So that's where my interest was as a lead picker with the banjo, but also a supporter with the banjo.
What was life on the road like with Bill Monroe?
It was terrible. If I hadn't been 21 years old and full of energy, just came off in a farm and a thread mill where I could, you know, I thought to do an hour show on the road was a pushover compared to 8 hours in the mill or from sunup to sundown on the farm. And music was my love, so to get into a group that had good singing and playing, and Bill had that, especially good singing and had good fiddle player. So I went in, and it just seemed to make a full band, especially for that style of music. That was long before anybody had tagged it as bluegrass. It was just country music, but it really made an outstanding group for that day and time, especially.
But why did you hate traveling so much with the band?
Why did I hate it?
Mm-hmm.
It was because we did it 24 hours a day, practically. Back then, there was only two-lane highways, and he traveled in a 41 Chevrolet car. And we'd leave after the opera on Saturday night and maybe work down in South Georgia, about as far as you could get for a Sunday afternoon show, and on down to Miami someplace for Monday or Tuesday, and work till about Thursday and start working back to Nashville. So it was just, you'd only be in Nashville long enough to do the Grand Ole Opry and to get a change of clothes and pack your suitcase and head out again. I was single at the time, so I was living in a hotel and had one suitcase. And I had to really work on it to keep clean clothes for every night doing a show on the road.
Musician Earl Scruggs speaking to Terry Gross in 2003. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to Terry's 2003 interview with bluegrass musician Earl Scruggs, who died Wednesday at the age of 88.
Now, it was in the Bill Monroe Band that you met guitarist Lester Flatt, who became your long musical partner. What were your first impressions of him when you first heard him play and sing?
Well, I liked his singing, and his playing fit in good with that style of music. And we palled around together. You know, in a group, you kind of find one or two guys that you like better than the other part of the group or the other maybe interest in things that you don't care for. So anyway, Lester and I got along with each other and roomed together. And so we did that for 2.5 or 3 years. And that's when we never had talked about starting a show ourselves. But I had made up my mind that I was going to just get off the road. So I worked 2 weeks' notice, and when I started to leave that night, Lester turned in his notice. And while he was working his notice, he gave me a call over North Carolina and said, "Why don't we get on the radio station over close to your home and try it as a group ourselves?" So that's how we got started with the Foggy Mountain Boys.
Now, you started recording. You and Lester Flatt started recording in, I think it was 1948. And for the first couple of years, you recorded for Mercury Records.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
During that period, you recorded what became one of your best-known songs, Foggy Mountain Breakdown.
Yeah.
Is there a story behind the song?
Well, it's just a simple song that I probably wrote in 10 or 15 minutes. And And I've written several other tunes and had some pretty big hits, but nothing like Foggy Mountain Breakdown. You'll have a ringer, as I call it, one that might make a hit with just about everybody. And so Foggy Mountain Breakdown was one of them. And it got a lot of support, like in the film Bonnie and Clyde movie. They used it as a chase song, and that supported that tune a lot. So the tune did a lot for not only me, but it did a lot for a situation like that in a movie.
How did Foggy Mountain Breakdown end up being used in the movie Bonnie and Clyde?
he called and wanted me to write a tune for
them. Who called?
Warren Beatty,
mm-hmm.
who wrote and starred in the show. And so he called back. I think I'm quoting this exactly the way it was. In a few days, and he said he didn't want me to write anything because he'd found a tune that he thought fit what he wanted. See, we recorded that tune before they got what I say good equipment. I mean, just plain everyday microphones and a radio station and no to start making tunes sound fuller or something. It was just raw material. Well, that, I mean, it didn't have no echo chamber or anything on it. So that's what Warren Beatty heard in that tune. So he didn't want to try to record another tune because he thought that the equipment that they had then was probably would give it a more modern tune than what we had recorded, which turned out to be Foggy Mountain Breakdown and the sound that we got then.
So you're saying that he used the original recording and he didn't want you to re-record it?
He took the Mercury recording, and that was it.
Why don't we hear that original recording of Foggy Mountain Breakdown, and this is Lester Flatt and my guest, Earl Scruggs. Original recording of Foggy Mountain Breakdown, which was later used in Bonnie and Clyde, featuring Lester Flatt on guitar, Earl Scruggs on banjo. My guest is Earl Scruggs. Now you mentioned what when you got off the road with Bill Monroe, what you wanted to do was a radio show. And first you did one in Bristol. Then mm-hmm. in 1953, you ended up doing a radio show in Nashville at a station there. And
WSM, yeah.
Yeah, and it was, I think, a 15-minute program every morning at 5:45, which is pretty darn early to have to perform.
We'd come in 2 o'clock and go to bed and get up at 4 to try to get awake enough to do a live radio program. But that was your bread and butter in those days. By that, I mean we made our living by the road work that we did. We'd go out and do shows and charge admission and get a percentage of that and also some flat rate too. But that just put us to working in better,
the show,
bigger auditoriums and bigger crowds.
The show was sponsored by Martha White Flower.
Yeah.
And I understand the jingle for that became pretty well known and you were even requested to play it at some of your concerts. I've never heard it. How did it go?
Now you bake bright. With Martha White, goodness gracious, good and light, Martha White, for the finest biscuits, cakes, and pies, gets Martha White self-rising flour. And the group says, the one all-purpose flour, get Martha White self-rising flour. It's got hot rise. Hot rise was actually a baking soda that went into the bread that would, it makes bread rise, you know that yourself, being a lady.
So...
But I thought it was pretty cleverly written.
So did you get, like, a lifetime supply of free Martha White flour?
Oh, no. Oh, no. They would probably have done that. But I got a lifetime of work with Martha White. It's a great company, and they helped us just more than I could total up, I guess.
How long did that show last?
I wish my wife was in here. She could tell you better than me, but it lasted for a lot of years, and we went into television. Television came in about 1955, so they put us, we started transcribing the morning show, radio show, and we'd sleep late, but we'd have to do a live television show at a different city each night. And the reason I say a live radio, television, that was before they had cameras to film you with. So we'd have to, we'd leave 4 o'clock Monday morning to go to down in Georgia. Had two cities in Georgia, Atlanta being one. And let's see, Wednesday was Florence, South Carolina. Thursday was Huntington, West Virginia. And Friday was Jackson, Tennessee, down West Tennessee. And Saturday back at WSM Television and do the Grand Ole Opry on Saturday night. And if we were working on Sunday, we were free until 4 o'clock Monday morning. And we started that 2,500-mile tour again.
Banjo player Earl Scruggs speaking to Terry Gross in 2003. He died Wednesday in Nashville at age 88. We'll hear more of Terry's interview with Earl Scruggs in the second half of the show. I'm David Bean Cooley, and this is Fresh Air.
Step it up and go.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Angie's List, with reviews on local contractors and doctors in 500 categories with ratings based only on member feedback. Angie'sList.com. From DreamWorks Pictures and Touchstone Home Entertainment, with War Horse from director Steven Spielberg on Blu-ray April 3rd, rated PG-13. And from PBS, exploring the history and legacy of the Grand Coulee Dam on American Experience Tuesday night on PBS. Local times may vary. This is NPR.
Writer Harry Cruse related to the hard luck characters, freaks, and losers that populated his Southern Gothic novels. He died Wednesday at the age of 76. Coming up, we listen back to our 1988 interview with him. Also, AMC's The Killing and HBO's Game of Thrones are back for season 2. I'll have a review. And more with Earl Scruggs.
I'm a flower that's blooming in the mountain so high. I'm a flower that's blooming there for me.
This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bean Cooley, in for Terry Gross, back with more of Terry's 2003 interview with bluegrass musician Earl Scruggs. He died Wednesday at age 88. Scruggs already had been a celebrated country artist for decades when he and Lester Flatt scored big with two massive crossover hits. One was featured in the movie Bonnie and Clyde, and the other in a TV show whose theme song invited us to come listen to a story about a man named Jed.
Well, I want to ask you about another crossover hit that you had. And this, of course, was the theme for the Beverly Hillbillies, the Ballad of Jed Clampett, which got you like the number one record on the country music charts. It crossed over to the pop charts. And, of course, it was on TV every week for years.
Mm-hmm.
And it's still on a lot in reruns. How were you asked to write the theme for the Beverly Hillbillies?
I didn't write the theme.
I mean, to record the theme, yeah.
Yeah. Well, I wish my wife was in here because she does all my business things, and she could tell you exactly how it came about. But we had done a show.
Wait, let me stop you. She's in the control room listening to the interview, right?
Yeah.
Why don't we invite her in, and she could tell us the story about the phone call. How's that?
She's on her way in.
Okay,
so
great.
So just hold that question. She'll be in a little bit. Now, Louise, say something. See if she
Hello.
Can. Oh, that's much
One,
better.
One, two, three.
Now
great.
I can hear you
okay.
in my okay. headphones, too.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Is this Louise Scruggs?
Yes, it is.
Okay. Well, can you tell us the story about the phone call inviting your husband to record the theme for the Beverly Hillbillies?
Well, Mr. Paul Henning, who wrote and directed the Beverly Hillbillies show, called before, of course, before it went on the air. He had written the show, and he called and wanted Earl and Lester to do the theme music. And I turned it down at first because of the word Beverly Hillbillies. I didn't know what connotation that was going to take with country people and didn't want to offend them. So he said, well, the premise of this show is that the Beverly Hillbillies are going to always be outsmarting the city slickers. So anyway, we talked about that two or three times, and he ended up sending the film, the pilot, to Nashville for us to see. And after we looked at it, we thought, okay, that looks all right. So they went ahead and recorded it. And while they were doing the theme music, I said to Perry Bodkin, who was a music director at the time, I think that would make a great single. And so I called Mr. Henning and I said, what do you think if they about them recording that for a single for Columbia Records? And he said, I think it's a great idea. So I spoke to their A&R director, Mr. Don Law, who was doing their records at the time. And so they recorded it 3 weeks later. And then it was released in October, and December 8th, 1962, it hit number one in Billboard.
On the country chart?
Yeah, right. And then it was up in the pop chart, too.
Louise Scruggs, you handled the business end of Flatt & Scruggs. How did the theme song from the Beverly Hillbillies affect business for the band?
Well, I started getting, after the show started airing, I started getting calls for them for dates and concerts. And within about a month, I had them booked up for a year in advance.
Okay.
So it was tremendous. Eventually ended up being shown in 76 countries around the world. So what it did, actually, insofar as spreading country music, it helped country music, and it helped, well, in the banjo in particular, because Earl gets mail from people all over the world.
Well, Louise Scruggs, thank you for stopping in for part of the interview. We really appreciate it. Earl Scruggs, you're still there?
Yes.
Great. Yeah. So you and Lester Flatt do not sing on the theme at all, right?
No, we just did the music.
Just the music,
part.
Right, good. Okay.
And Jerry Scoggins, a West Coast person, did the vocal on the theme that you hear on the Beverly Hillbillies. We did record it for Columbia Records, but that was later.
And when you recorded it, you sang it?
Lester did. Mm-hmm.
And why don't we hear the theme from the Beverly Hillbillies with Lester Flatt and my guest Earl Scruggs.
And listen to my story about a man named Jed. Poor mountaineer, barely kept his family fed. And then one day he was shooting at some food, and up through the ground come a bubbling crude. All that is black gold, Texas tea.
If you're just joining us, my guest is banjo player Earl Scruggs. Now, why did you and Lester Flatt split up?
Well, the biggest thing for me, see, I had three boys coming along. Gary, Randy, and Steve was my youngest boy. And they were good musicians. And as a matter of fact, Randy had been recording with Lester and me as far as the guitar work ever since he's 7 or 8 years old. So I just had a band in my home, and one of the biggest thrills a person will ever get is to go on stage with his children, especially if they're good musicians, and I'll have to brag on them, even though they are my boys. I thought some of the best musicians I'd ever played with, so it was a great outlet for me to start working with my boys.
Did you stay close with Lester Flatt, and what kind of terms were you on when he died in 1979?
We were friends. I just didn't see him that much because I was on the road so much in the direction we were going, and he of course, he kept to show himself, and he worked as long as he was able to work, really. Yeah. So I always, and still today, though he's been dead for several years, I still have a warm spot in my heart and cherish the days that we worked and traveled together.
There is a Gibson banjo that mm-hmm. is named for you. It's called the Earl.
Yeah.
It has a portrait of you
yeah.
on it and your signature. Is it a lot of fun to have, you know, a banjo that's dedicated to you, that bears your name and likeness?
It is. And as a matter of fact, they're making five different models with my name on it, from the plain banjo, which they're all basically the same banjo. What runs up the cost is like gold plating and engraving and things of that nature.
Do you play one of those Gibsons, or do you play something else?
Well, yeah, I play a Gibson banjo.
Is it an Earl?
Well, basically it is. I'm playing a banjo that I've been playing since back in the late 40s, I guess, early 50s. But it's still basically, they're still making basically the same banjo they were making way back there.
When you say you're still playing the same banjo, do you mean it's literally the same instrument or that it's the same model?
Yeah. Same banjo.
Same banjo. So do you have to get mm-hmm. it, like, redone occasionally?
Well, the only thing you're going to wear out on the banjo is the head. The head is used to be skin, but now it's plastic. They will wear out on you. And the strings, outside of that, you play one for 1,000 years unless you got it broken some way.
Now, what do you love so much about this banjo? Is it just a sentimental attachment, or is there something special about the sound?
Well, it produces the sound that my ear's looking for. Maybe I've just gotten used to it, but I like the sound that I get out of that particular banjo. I feel at home with it when I take it out of the case and start, you know, when you start with another instrument, they all have their feel, and playing the same instrument, you know what it's going to feel like when you take it out of the case and start to perform.
Well, I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
Been my pleasure.
Banjo player Earl Scruggs speaking to Terry Gross in 2003. He died Wednesday at age 88. Coming up, we remember another Southern artist who died that day, author Harry Cruz. This is Fresh Air. Harry Cruz was the kind of writer who loved darkly comic characters and deeply twisted people, and great titles. His novels include A Feast of Snakes, Naked in Garden Hills, Scar Lover, and The Hawk is Dying. He died Wednesday in Gainesville, Florida, where he taught creative writing for many decades at the University of Florida. He was 76 years old. The New York Times obituary of Harry Cruz called him a Georgia-born Rabelais. Cruz also wrote essays and a memoir titled A Childhood, Biography of a Place, about his rural Georgia childhood during the Great Depression. But he's most famous for his fiction, featuring freaks and losers with unusual gifts. Terry Gross spoke with Harry Cruz in 1988 upon the publication of his novel, The Knockout Artist. It's about a boxer who leaves rural Georgia to try to make it big in New Orleans. Here's Cruz reading the opening paragraph.
From where he sat on a low stool, the boy, whose name was Eugene Talmadge Biggs, but who was often called Knockout or KO or Knocker, had counted the suits hanging in the open closet three times. And each time he counted them, he came up with a different number. That did not surprise him. He was not a good counter. It was just something to do until it was time for him to go out and do the only thing he had left. Besides, nothing much surprised him anymore.
You know, as we get deeper into your novel, we understand that this boxer is about to fight for the pleasure of this wealthy man and his crazy friends, and that the boxer's specialty is actually knocking himself out by punching himself in the jaw. Did you actually know anybody who could do that, who could knock himself out by a self-imposed blow?
Well, strangely enough, I did. I don't think, however, it's what caused me to write the book, but I did. My brother was a professional fighter. He was 22-2 when he broke his right hand. And I spent a good deal of my early manhood in fight gymnasiums of one kind or another. And boxed as an amateur myself.
This character in your novel basically is forced to make his living through self-debasement. Do you know what I mean? Instead of really being able to use his talent of boxing, he has this vulnerable jaw. So he knocks himself out, and it's people relate to him because it's self-debasement.
Let's get one thing clear.
Yeah.
He does do what he does, and if you want to call it self-debasement, that's fine. But he doesn't have to do it. Nobody's holding a gun to his head. The boy is doing what he is doing because he lost the only thing he could do, which was fight effectively as a professional. And then because he has people he loves very much who are counting on him for money to sustain them, namely his family back in Georgia, he being in New Orleans during this novel, he does this to make money, all of which he sends home.
Well, do you relate to his predicament?
Oh, do I ever.
So what are some of the things that you felt that you were forced to do that you didn't really want to do?
Oh, well, now we're on the radio, aren't we?
That bad?
No, not that bad. I suppose having to earn a living in ways that I would not elect to have earned that living for people who were looking for me for something to eat and a place to stay.
You know, critics always describe your novels as being centered around characters who are freakish or abnormal. Would you agree with that?
Well, yes, all right, yes, certainly I would agree with that. For instance, there in the first three novels, there is a midget in all three novels. A different guy, but a midget in each of the first three novels. They're very different people, but there are midgets, and there are people who are deformed one way or another, and
You know, I've just been reading your autobiography about your early life until you were around 6 years old. It's called A Childhood.
Yeah.
And from that book, I really get the impression that during part of your childhood, you really felt like a freak. You had polio when you were five, and your legs were just
bent. My legs drew up until the heel was against the buttock. That is, the legs drew up as tightly as they could draw. And, yeah, I know what it's like to have people look at you and their face mirror your own rather dreadful circumstances, that is to say, your freakishness. And sure, I felt like a freak there. And I wrote about that thing, as you say, in A Childhood. But, of course, there were other times I felt freakish, too. Not just there, but other places, many other places. For instance, when I left the farm and went into the Marine Corps, here I am, a boy off a tenant farm in South Georgia, who, among other things, just one thing, I didn't know what a pizza was. Never heard of one.
No kidding.
Didn't know what pepperoni was. So I go to Paris Island in the Marine Corps in a platoon of boys from where? Well, New Jersey, New York, of course. And, well, everything about my speech, the idiom of my speech, was all wrong. And I felt very strange and was made to feel very strange. And as a matter of fact, if you let me pursue this for just a minute, it's one of the things that caused me to have such a very, very long apprenticeship when otherwise it may not have been necessary. Because I wrote four novels and a rather large room full of short stories before I ever published anything. And the reason I didn't publish any of those things is because the stuff wasn't any good. And the reason it wasn't any good is I was trying to write about a world I did not know.
Which world was it, and whose voices were you trying to write with?
Oh, I was trying to write about people who had families and who grew up in the same house, and about people who, if they were unfortunate enough to have hookworm and rickets, were able to go to the doctor, and about people who knew about automobiles and not about mules. And so I take it as a moment of grace that one night very late when I was working, it for whatever reason occurred to me that whatever strength I had was all back there in Bacon County, Georgia, with all that sickness and, as I say, hookworm and rickets and ignorance and beauty and loveliness and the rest of it, such as it was. But that's where it was. It wasn't somewhere else.
Can I read you the inscription to your novel and ask you about it? You dedicate your novel to Rod and Debbie Elrod, mm-hmm. who made every effort to keep me sane and very nearly succeeded during the struggle to write this book.
Mm-hmm.
Were you having serious problems when you were writing the book? I mean, all writers talk about going insane while they're writing books, but was there something especially crazy that was happening to you while you were writing this?
Not any more so than has been true of the other books I've written, and I don't want to go on too much about it or make it sound too precious, and I don't think I suffer any more than any other writer does. I think some writers manage to live with what for me is the tension and the anxiety and the general scariness of writing a book. I think some writers manage all that better than I do. I never manage it very well. And my behavior takes various forms, or has in the past, when I'm writing a book. For the last, I don't mind saying this, everybody in this town knows it anyway, and most of the people who know me around the country know it. For the last 12 years, probably, I've been a really, really bad drunk. But it was a curious form of drunkenness. If I wasn't working, I wasn't a drunk. And then you say, well, no, wait a minute, that's stupid. You can't write and drink. Well, I know that. But I can stop writing and or get so scared or warped or twisted and stop writing and get drunk for 3 or 4 days and nights or 2 weeks and then stop drinking and go back to it.
Well, you know, you've alluded in one of your essays to thinking of yourself as someone who has to hold himself back from giving in to his worst impulses.
Yeah, and that gets right back to some of the stuff we were talking about earlier. I like the edge, or another way to say that is when things get too comfortable and things get too safe, I get the feeling like I'm smothering. It's like somebody's burying me in feathers. And so when things get too safe and too secure, then I have a tendency to start tearing things up or tearing things down, as the case may be. And but I, as I grow older, I seem to be doing better with all that, much to the relief of the people around me, I think.
Well, I wish you the best, and I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, God bless you. It was my great pleasure, and I hope it was all right.
That was Terry Gross speaking with writer Harry Cruz in 1988. He died Wednesday at age 76. Coming up, let's talk TV, the season premieres of AMC's The Killing and HBO's Game of Thrones. I'll have a review. I'm David Biancooley, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm TV critic David Biancooley. Two cable TV series that drew a lot of attention during their first seasons are back Sunday night to start a second year. One hoping to build on the momentum from some positive late-season buzz, the other hoping to overcome some negative buzz from last year's cliffhanger. AMC's The Killing started strong, with raves from critics and an impressively loyal core of viewers. But in the final episode of the year, when it left its season-long murder mystery intentionally unresolved, most fans felt angry, even betrayed. HBO's Game of Thrones, on the other hand, took a bit longer to get established and to get as much attention. But thanks to some strong performances and a few bold strokes of plot, Game of Thrones, based on the popular George R.R. Martin fantasy novels of neighboring kingdoms at war, kept building in intensity and in viewership all the way to the season finale. That finale ended with the fiery birth of a dragon, but by then, that was the only part of Game of Thrones that was dragon. The Killing, on the other hand, seemed to almost limp to the end of season one, spending entire episodes on red herrings or subplot detours. But now, Sunday night on their respective networks, these two shows return, and they both revert to old habits. The Killing, in other words, starts strong again. The central question from last year, who killed Rosie Larson, quickly comes back into play. And with it, there are new leads, new confrontations, even some new characters introduced. However, AMC has requested an embargo of so many plot points that there's virtually no scene I can play without revealing too much about the fate of the show's characters and investigation. So I'll play along, which means I won't play a clip. What I will say, though, is by the time the two-hour premiere is over, we learn a lot, and many questions indeed are answered. But with some of the answers come some new questions, such as, why didn't this clue or this witness surface before? Does this person's behavior really make sense? And finally, is it really worth caring about these characters all over again? My answer to that last question is yes, but you'll have to answer that one for yourself. Whether to commit to these ongoing complicated narrative TV series, and when, and for how long, is a very subjective choice. For example, it took me about 5 episodes last season to get fully into Game of Thrones. That's when Peter Dinklage, as a formidable member of the Lannister clan, finally won me over. And I wasn't alone. Later that year, he won an Emmy. By the time season one was over, there were a handful of characters who entertained me consistently, and most of them, though not all, even managed to survive to show up again for season two. There's Dinklage, of course, who returns to the Lannister kingdom more influential than ever, thanks to a scroll that gives him power by proxy. He reveals that scroll, and his new role, by barging into a high council session presided over by his power-hungry sister, played by Lena Headey. It's just the latest move in their very high-stakes game of sibling rivalry.
What are you doing here? This is the small council.
Yes. Well, I do believe the hand of the king is welcome at all small council meetings.
Our father is hand of the king.
Yes, but in his absence...
Your father has named Lord Tyrion to serve as hand in his stead while he fights...
Out! All of you, out! I'd like to know how you tricked Father into this.
If I were capable of tricking Father, I'd be Emperor of the World by now. You brought this on yourself.
I done nothing.
Quite right. You did nothing. When your son called for Ned Stark's head, now the entire North has risen up against us.
I tried to stop it.
Did you? You failed. That bit of theater will haunt our family for a generation.
Rob Stark is a child.
Who's won every battle he's fought? Do you understand we're losing the war?
What do you know about warfare?
Nothing. But I know people. And I know that our enemies hate each other almost as much as they hate us.
Season 2 of Game of Thrones gets more expansive, even literally. It covers more ground, roams new corners of the kingdom, even introduces new characters. But the old habit to which Game of Thrones reverts is an overly patient fascination with its own world and all the people in it. Once again, at spots, I found myself not knowing who certain characters were, and not caring, especially when central stories were sidelined. But both these series, in their second seasons, are heading somewhere. The Killing will solve its mystery. And Game of Thrones, before this season is out, will go to war. As a TV viewer who's already watching too many novelistic shows each week, I say, let it happen quickly. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Additional engineering support from Joyce Lieberman and Julian Hersfeld. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Melody Kramer is our associate producer of online media. Roberta Sherrock directs the show. For Terry Gross, I'm David Bean Cooley.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Progressive Insurance with Snapshot, which monitors mileage and safe driving habits to determine a personalized rate. More at progressive.com. From the Poetry Foundation, celebrating 100 years of Poetry Magazine, online at poetryfoundation.org. And from the William and Flora Hewlett Foundation, making grants to solve social and environmental problems at home and around the world. On the web at hewlett.org. This is NPR.
Love me or leave me.
On the next Fresh Air, Doris Day. There's a new CD-DVD set of her recordings and films. She's also the star of the month on TCM, and she's about to turn 88. Also, comic Aziz Ansari. He has a new online comedy special. Join us. Somebody else.